I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, we're going to add some suggestions for your summer reading list. And with us this morning, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
Also with us is Mary Fran Buckley from Eight Cousins Bookstore. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right. So I guess first we want to start with Eight Cousins is back up and running. Yay.
Yay. Yippee. Yes, we are. We're very excited to be up and running. We were closed for 3 months.
Following the water damage.
Yeah, we had a flood from the apartment above the store. A pipe broke. I shut the doors Monday, January 8th at 7 o'clock. Nothing was going on. And at 8:45 the next day, Sarah Hines called me to say the ceiling had fallen in. Oh. And I couldn't figure out how that could be with two apartments above us. But when I got to the store, the water damage was just unbelievable. Water had run all night. I think it was still running when we got there.
Oh, no.
The ceiling tiles had absorbed all the water and fallen throughout the store. So it actually was total damage. We did manage to save the office computers. We got them out as quickly as we could. And Wood Lumber, thanks to Eileen Miskell and Dana, her husband, who own it. And Eileen is also one of the owners of Eight Cousins. We had a home there. We brought the computers to a basement room. And we're able for 3 months to operate out of Eight Cousins.
Out of Wood Lumber.
Of Wood Lumber, of course.
Yeah. But now everything's, you've got it all renovated.
Once things started, everything fell into place, and we are up and running and very excited.
Yeah. And it looks beautiful.
Oh,
having
thank
been
you, Jill.
In the store, it looks great. You actually have sort of rearranged things a little bit. They have a little more space, and everyone should stop by and see it.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we should talk about, we're talking about summer reading. Jill, you want to give us, because summer reading, that list can be different for different, likes.
Absolutely. And of course, summer reading is something I remember very fondly from my childhood, which is a lot long ago and far away now. However, I do think when you're on Cape Cod and the islands, you see that a lot of people, in fact, are spending time wherever they are, whether they're in a cabin, on the beach, in a tent, and they are reading, and they do want suggestions. I have discovered, surprisingly, I heard this information on the CBS Sunday Morning, which is a great show, and they had this little CBS News report on summer reading, and it says, according to their info, and they actually did a poll on this, in spite of the tradition of having a summer reading list, Americans read more books in the winter than in the summer. When asked in which season they read the most books, 40% said winter, more than twice as many as the 17% who said summer. Far fewer still read the most books in either fall, 7%, or spring, 4%. So I was sort of surprised at this, but I think when you're in a tourist town, a summer tourist town, there's a lot of reading that goes on once people get here. And even now in the age of distraction, reading, summer reading particularly, is still a wonderful thing to sort of take your mind off of the rest of the world. And I found also this very funny article in the Falmouth Enterprise. This is from September 4th, 1959. And it's interesting to me that this ran in September because it's about summer reading. So I think they were responding to what the kids have been asked to read over the summer. And let me just read you a little bit of this because it's so funny. The title of this story, and I don't know who wrote this. It was a weekly column called Book Corner. And the headline on this was Summer Reading from a Second-Rate Encyclopedia. And it begins, on a list of books recommended by the school guidance director as recreational, and the author puts that in quotations, reading for Falmouth's sixth graders during the summer just passed was one titled Your Telephone and How It Works. Just what a youngster would want to curl up with on a long, drowsy summer afternoon. There are 51 books on this summer reading list. The titles are about as appetizing as castor oil. The list is divided among headings. One of the divisions is labeled Fun and Fancy. It contains only 5 titles.
Oh, no.
Anyway, it goes on. I'll put a link up to this when we post the book list. Very funny article and a really interesting sort of take on what summer reading was in the town of Falmouth in 1959.
Right. And I would imagine that, Mary Fran, you get a lot of questions from people coming in who want, especially when they're visiting, like, Cape books
right.
about,
local books. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But I will say we always have all the school lists and they've come a long way, Jill.
They have. Yes.
No instructions on the telephone these days.
This is true.
I would say it's the opposite. We need the kids to show us how to work our
exactly.
phones.
Exactly.
That's right. All right, so let's get into the books. You want to start, Jill? What have you got first?
Sure. I'll start with one. I want to especially mention this because I have, for months now, I've been trying to figure out what show I could actually talk about this book on because it is sort of unusual and it is a really beautiful book, and we have yet to kind of get to a topic that would allow it to happen. However, this is it. This would be a great summer reading book. It is, in fact, about a woman. It's called Florine Stettheimer, and the subtitle is Painting Poetry. And Florine Stettheimer, for the many of you that may never have heard of her, I, in fact, had not heard of her until quite recently, lived in New York City and two of her sisters also lived in New York City. They all lived with the mother, and they were all very well-to-do and all a little bit eccentric. They hung out with people like Gertrude Stein, so, you know, this is sort of the kind of milieu they were in. But they have recently, in the last year, done a major retrospective of her artwork. And one of the great things about her artwork is a lot of it takes place in summer, thus the connection to the summer reading. But they are beautiful. And she also has little summer poems in here as well. And you can see well, those of you in the studio can see that they are beautiful illustrations. And here's a little bitty poem for you. It's called Asbury Park. It swings, it rings, it's full of noisy things. It's stretched along the water on a boardwalk. Hooray, we are gay, is what the crowd say, lying stretched on land along the water sand.
Just it's a beautiful, the cover of the book.
Yes.
Very
her paintings are beautiful. It's a beautiful, I think that in every one of these paintings that she has done, there are at least 10 short stories you could write just looking at them. If you look at them carefully, her mother shows up repeatedly in these pictures. There is one great one that is called Just Heat, which was done in 1919. And it is of her family and her mother all just sort of stretched out on chaise lounges looking
hot.
Exhausted and hot because they're in the city. And she has a little poem on New York. In spring, my friends droop. They disappear. June is empty of them. In autumn, they come back stuffed full of Europe. So, you know, her friends were something. Now, one of the sisters also spent 25 years building a doll's house and collecting for the doll's house and putting little miniature artists' artwork in this doll house, which you actually can still see in New York City. It is on display. There are photos of that in this book as well. So you're in for a real treat if you have never seen Florine Stettheimer's paintings or read her poems. And I know that at least one of her paintings is at the Boston MFA, but you can now plan for your trip to New York City to see the dollhouse as well. So it's Florine Stettheimer, Painting Poetry.
All right, Mary Friend, what's yours?
Okay, I'm going way back in time. Not way back, but first I'd like to quote one of my co-owners, Sarah Hines, who defines summer reads as New England summer reads. And we'd say they have a little more edge than maybe the average summer read. So that's a little push for the area. So this book, I think, was published in 1988. I know I read it the year that it came out. It's Rosamund Pilcher's The Shell Seekers, and it was just reissued last summer. And I brought it in, and I tell you, every woman who passed the table said, oh, I love that book. And I had a customer who came in just the other day and said, I read that book in 1988, the year that my daughter was born, and I just loved it. So it has a lot of fond memories. It's a multi-generational story. It's Penelope Keeling is the main character, and she owns a painting that her father did called The Shell Seekers. She has three children, Nancy, Noelle, and Olivia. And Olivia is the most like her. The other two are a little bit different. Penelope is a free spirit. She was a very lively, wonderful woman. Olivia and she are sort of soul sisters in a way. And it's the story of her aging. She's just had a heart attack. Penelope has returned home, much to the dismay of her three children. And the oldest, Nancy, is wondering, what are we going to do with her? How can we take care of her? And then she finds out that this painting, The Shell Seekers, is worth a lot of money. And so some of the greed in the family comes out. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful read. It's a long book, but it's an easy read.
Yeah. Sometimes those long books, when you get to the end and you're like, no, I don't want to be done.
You don't want it to end.
Let's start over. Yeah. Right. Yes.
All right. What's next, Jill?
Well, I have a house book that sounds absolutely fabulous. These are things right now that are on my summer reading list. I haven't necessarily read them yet, but they all sound amazing. And this one is called The House at Lobster Cove, a novel by Jane Goodrich. And this was brought to my attention through a business called Bas Bleu. I don't know how many of your listeners know about that, but basically it's a online book seller, but they sell a lot of other, as they say, they sell eclectic books and bookish things. And apparently one of the things they've done in the last year is that they now, you can order like a whole year of books and they'll send you a book every month, which was sort of
like
interesting
the book of the
idea,
month club,
like
right?
The book of the month club, only you don't know what's coming. So this book, The House at Lobster Cove, turns out to be one of the books that's is on their list. And they say about it, not only did our reviewer hail the novel as having the grace, wit, language, and incisive character exploration of Edith Wharton's work, but Jane Goodrich's debut novel features a beautiful letterpress printed rendering of the titular house on its cover, because it turns out the author is also the co-owner of Saturn Press. And I don't know if you've seen their cards before,
yes,
but they make beautiful,
I
bet you
yeah.
have at the yeah. store. They make beautiful cards and stationery. And so what happened was, as a teenager, the author fell in love with images of this house called Cragside. And it was a 19th century Massachusetts shingle style house, which was torn down in the 1920s. As an adult, she and her husband obtained the plans and spent 15 years rebuilding the house on an island in Maine. Now she has written this marvelous novel about the unique life of philanthropist George Nixon Black, who commissioned the design and building of the original Cragside. So you've got this house in Maine, and then you got the guy that actually originally built the house. And the guy that originally built the house, according to Fine Books and Collections, which is a great magazine if you've never seen it, they wrote this up. And it turns out George Nixon Black lived from 1842 to 1928, was a Boston-based heir to a real estate fortune, philanthropist, and collector. And in Jane Goodrich's fictionalized biography, Violence and Unhappiness Give Way to Secret Romance, born in a rough-and-tumble timber town in Maine, Nixon's privileged childhood is marked with turmoil, his family moves to Boston, and Nixon's nascent homosexuality requires stealth and secrecy while navigating a world filled with buttoned-up Brahmins. And so it tells the story. It's basically the novel is telling the story of this man who lived with his partner in this house in Maine, never letting anybody in Boston know that he was living in this house with this man. Sounds like a great story, and just the book itself is beautifully done. So that is called The House at Lobster Cove by Jane Goodrich.
All right, Mary Fran, what's your next book?
All right, I'm going back in time again, and I have to confess I didn't read this book. I listened to it, and listened to it on a road trip and laughed out loud. So almost anything by Bill Bryson could be a summer read because he's so entertaining. But this is The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid. And anybody who grew up in the 50s would really enjoy this. The his mother gets a bad rap, I think, in this one, in serving TV dinners. But it's all the things that people of a certain age remember. Bill Bryson was born in the middle of the century, 1951, and in the middle of the country. And this is his fantasy life as the Thunderbolt Kid. So anybody who watched Superman, loved superhero comics, would identify with how he identifies with the Thunderbolt Kid. So it's Bill Bryson, The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid.
Is the Thunderbolt Kid, so is that like a Superman character?
Yes. Well, it's his own.
It's his own. Oh,
yes.
So, okay.
Yeah.
What's his superpower? You haven't read that one, so you don't
know. No. I have.
I listened to it,
so I do remember it. I think he could do numerous things.
Yeah.
And the cover is just wonderful. He's got one of those 50s-era space hats and a space gun. So he's armed and ready to go.
All right. We are talking about summer reading lists this morning, and we will talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about summer reading and having some suggestions for your summer reading list. With us this morning is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Mary Fran Buckley from Eight Cousins Bookstore. Jill, what's your next book?
Well, what would summer be on Cape Cod if there weren't mermaids around, right? You always have to know that there are going to be mermaids around. And I was fortunate enough to come across a list by a fellow named Matt Staggs called 10 Mermaid Books Perfect for the Beach, one of which looks absolutely fascinating. Brand new book called The Pisces by Melissa Browder. And it is the main character is reeling from a dramatic breakup with her boyfriend of 9 years, Lucy, a burned out graduate student. She heads out to Los Angeles to house sit for a friend. But while sitting alone one night at Venice Beach, Lucy spots a handsome and enigmatic swimmer. The chance encounter leads to a relationship unlike any she has ever experienced, because the man she thinks she's dating is not human at all. Oh. He is a merman, a creature of legend that will challenge Lucy's very notion of love. So not a mermaid in this case, a merman, but it's really... I've started to read it. It looks like it's going to be a great read. Here's a little bit what she goes through when she first meets him. She says, you are thinking, you know, he is a merman. And he says, ha, not really. But I mean, we aren't like the siren myths and stuff. It's not like we are trying to kill humans or keep them imprisoned on an island. We aren't like the way they are in the Odyssey. Homer slandered us, but we do live a long, long time, youthfully, hundreds of years. We spend most of them looking like we are in our late teens and early 20s. I think it's the salt water. It preserves us in some way.
Then so, we should be in luck.
So very funny. And also, though, it gets at some very serious issues. On the surface, as the Kirkus Review said, on the surface, this audacious novel from Browder is a frank exploration of desire, fantasy, and sex, but it dives deeper too, seeking out uncomfortable topics and bringing them into the light: codependency, depression, suicidal ideation, and an existential fascination with the void each get their days in the sun. This isn't just a novel about navigating the dangers of codependency, but an attempt to learn how we all might love better in a culture that pushes even its strongest women to the brink of self-destruction. So it is not a light read, but there clearly is some humor in it, and it is called The Pisces, Melissa Browder, if you want your summer reading to include a merman.
All right, Mary Fran, what have you got?
Oh, so I'm not going toward the water for a lot of my books, but another favorite of mine was Neville Shute's A Town Like Alice, another book that's a bit older, but one of the most beloved that Neville Shute wrote. And it's the story of Jean Paget, a British person, British woman living in Malaya. She's captured by the Japanese, and she and a group of women are sent on a 7-month march in Malaya. And along the way, she meets this Australian, and he does try to help the women. And for that, he's punished. He's beaten. She does get away. She gets back to England. She finds out she's an heiress. She has all this money. And what she wants to do is go back to the country and help the women dig a well. She had seen how tough their life was. That wasn't possible because of the politics. So she goes to Australia to find this man who had helped her. And he's in Alice Springs, and it's how she sets up her life there. Wonderful story. Terrific read. And it was also a beautiful masterpiece theater.
I was going to say, decades ago I saw that on PBS, right?
Yeah, and I will say that the production of Masterpiece Theater was just as good as the book. So, and you can dig that up, but I recommend reading the book. It's a wonderful, wonderful read.
Maybe read the book and then go search out
Masterpiece. That's it. You do in that order.
The book always has more. All right, Jill, what have you got?
Well, you know, should it ever get hot this summer, you might want a book that will give you a few chills. So it's always good to have a mystery at hand. And I am so excited about this group of books that has just been reprinted. I read actually a big article in the Wall Street Journal about this author. Her name is Margaret Miller. I would have said I had never heard of her before. She's a mystery writer in the 50s. But it turns out she It's a great story. Here's a little bit of what they said in the review. Margaret Miller, 1915 to 1994, she died in 94, who had her first and only child in Toronto in 1939 at the age of 24, adjusted initially by giving her infant daughter over to the care of female relatives and taking to bed with an imagined, she would later confess, heart ailment. There, she read dozens of detective stories brought home for her from the library by her husband, Kenneth, who would soon take a job teaching high school in Kitchener, Ontario. The new mother, already frustrated in her youthful ambition to be a writer, threw one of these novels against a wall and vowed, "I could do better than that." In two bedridden weeks, she produced a handwritten draft of what would be the first work in a 27-book oeuvre. Mm. The entirety of that life work is now gathered in Collected Miller, a densely packed set of seven mostly omnibus volumes by the author who more or less invented the mystery subgenre dubbed psychological suspense.
Who knew?
I do know that the Library of America had put out something on women mystery writers, and one of those writers was her in that mm-hmm. volume. She is actually best known, apparently, for her Edgar Award-winning 1955 work, Beast in View, in which a well-to-do Beverly Hills woman, Helen Clairvaux, is menaced by telephone calls from a female she is certain means to destroy her. But how much faith should be put in Helen's perceptions, given her propensity for such Freudian slips as writing in a seemingly friendly letter to her mother, "I hope that all is hell with you." Is it Helen, perhaps, who is her own worst enemy? With the powerfully effective Beast in View, Miller pioneered, albeit in third-person prose, the currently ubiquitous device of the unreliable narrator. So I am really looking forward to reading The Beast in View, which starts with this creepy telephone call. But if you decide, and I don't think our library even has these yet, they've just recently been released, but I am definitely hoping we buy them all because I want to read my way through them. The collection is Collected Miller by Margaret Miller, and the particular novel that I am recommending is Beast in View.
All right, so this just goes, I can do better. So if you think so, give it a shot. That's you never
right.
know, right?
That's
you
could, right. You could, and you know, the next be thing the first you in the know, genre. That's right. That's right. And she actually turned out to be, I didn't know this either. Her husband was the guy who went by the pen name Ross McDonald. Huh. And you've probably heard of his mysteries. Yes. And he was a huge, I think his stuff is all still in print. I don't know how hers got out of print, but it is back. I think it'll be really interesting.
Mm. All right, Mary Fran.
Okay, continuing with the mysteries. I love reading mysteries.
I do too, yeah.
Yeah, they're so great and so entertaining. But I didn't want to, since it's summer, I didn't want to go with the Nordics. And so a customer had recommended to me, at one time, a couple customers have, Donna Leon and her character, Commissario Guido Brunetti. And so I did get the first, and I read it, and I am a fan. I just loved it. And she also has 27 books, but she's still alive and still writing, so she may have more in the series.
And they always make you want to go to Venice,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Well, my lead to this was, for those of us who can't travel this summer, we can do it through these books. And it's just a wonderful description of Venice. But her writing is so great. So I loved, she had me very early on when Guido Brunetti goes to the opera because the maestro, the conductor, has been found dead in his dressing room. So, still, only a short distance into the room, Brunetti remained still and let his eyes roam, taking note of what he saw, uncertain about what any of it might come to mean, curious. He was surprised. He was a surprisingly neat man, tie carefully knotted, hair shorter than was the fashion. Even his ears lay close to his head, as if reluctant to call attention to themselves. His clothing marked him as Italian. The cadence of his speech announced that he was Venetian. His eyes were all policemen. I just thought that was a wonderful description. And then later on, he's introduced to a friend of his wife's, and a man the same age, and instead of saying, he was pretty haggard looking, his description is, the man looked to be about the same age as Paola, although he had clearly had a harder time getting there. So the writing is clever, the descriptions of Venice, you feel like you're on the streets. He's a family man. He's not divorced and alcoholic, as so many of the darker characters right. are. In fact, on one evening, he goes home and plays Monopoly with his wife and two kids. So they're good reads, good travel, and just good writing.
Yeah.
So the first one in the series, Death at La Fenice, which is the opera, and the author is Donna Leone.
Thank you. All right, Jill.
Well, I've got some other mysteries as well. Mm. And this is, again, somebody who's new to me, and now I'm all excited to read more. I hope he keeps writing. The one that I have in my hand, which is the newest one, is called Murder in the Manuscript Room by Con Lehane. This is a sequel to his previous murder mystery, which was Murder at the 42nd Street Library. You may notice a theme here. And there, it's also, I have to say, there aren't many books that you open. And actually, I'm sure that all of the independent bookstores will also appreciate this. So what he has in his acknowledgments, he writes, "To the independent mystery bookstores that support me and writers like me by hand-selling our books and hosting author visits goes my eternal gratitude. Likewise, my gratitude to the nation's libraries that are responsible for probably half, if not more, of my overall sales, as they are for many mystery writers. In addition, librarians are among the staunchest defenders of our rights as Americans to read and write what we wish. Without libraries, writers, readers, and communities in general would be very, very much poorer indeed." So, you know, how can you not get interested in a story that starts and the acknowledgments begin with the library? And what happens in this particular one is a murder desecrates the somber book-lined halls of New York City's iconic 42nd Street Library. Raymond Ambler, the library's curator of crime fiction, has a personal interest in solving the crime. His quest to solve the murder is complicated by personal entanglements involving his friend, or perhaps more than friend, Adele Morgan. Not only does Adele's relationship with the young woman staffer who was murdered get in the way of Ambler's investigation, more disturbing for him is Adele's growing interest in a darkly handsome Islamic scholar. Soon, the intelligence division of the New York Police Department takes over the case from NYPD homicide detective Mike Cosgrove, Ambler's friend and sometimes partner in crime solving. So a very library-like book, and I think that anybody that likes their public library or their local bookstore would also like to read Murder in the Manuscript Room by Con Lehane, and it's got a blurb by Sarah Paresky on the cover. I love Sarah Paresky. If you haven't read her mysteries, you're in for a treat there as well.
All right. Mary Fran.
I was just going to add, too, in the mystery theme, Martin Walker, because he's another travel. He's French. He writes about Bruno, chief of police. And you don't have to start at the beginning. The first book is Bruno, chief of police. I started with The Dark Vineyard, and Bruno is wonderful. He knows his wine. He knows how to cook. He's just this wonderful man. He does have a bit of PTSD. He was a UN peacekeeper in the Bosnian wars, and he is the only policeman in his village. But they're wonderful for anybody who wants to travel to France. Wonderful descriptions of food and wine and life in the French countryside.
And I have to say, I love that you don't have to start at the first one, because I really, I am really a fan of single standalone mysteries, as opposed to having to read, you know, start with letter A, for example, read all the way through. Yeah. So that's great to know.
Yeah, good. I will say with Guido Brunetti, I've been recommended to read it in order because the kids grow older, as you know, and his family plays a major part in the books. And I will say too that Spencer Quinn and his Chet and Bernie mysteries are another just really delightful, funny books to read.
We talk about Peter Abrams.
He's our own Peter Abrams. Yeah. So.
And you know what's so fun about and especially if you're a dog person.
Absolutely.
I mean, you will laugh out loud with some. And it's, again, it's, as he always says, it's not a talking dog. You're kind of in the mind of the dog. But it just one scene in the book, I just remember where, you know, he's barking, and you know, Bernie's like, get off the bed. I'm on the bed, like, you know, like a dog would say, what? I'm on the bed, I'm barking on the bed.
He really does get into the dogs. And when he was talking at the bookstore once, a customer asked him, well, what kind of dog is Bernie? And he said, Bernie doesn't know. He's a dog. So he stays quite in character. And his kids' books are very good. Arf, Woof, and I can't remember the newest one.
Yeah.
But they're great.
Yeah.
Well, and before we get off of mysteries, I do want to mention that Cynthia Riggs has a new mystery called Widow's Wreath, a Martha's Vineyard mystery. I'm sure a lot of our listeners know Cynthia Riggs either personally or have read her work. And this one involves the 92 Victoria Trumbull, has lived her whole life in a big old house on beautiful Martha's Vineyard when her distant cousin, Penny Arbuthnot, asked to hold her wedding there. Victoria agreed, but now she's shocked to discover it's a huge extravaganza with 10 sound systems and more than 200 guests. And then the electrician wiring the ceremony finds a body wrapped in a sheet hanging in the seldom used cellar. So that should be a very wonderful read. That is coming out soon. I'm not sure it's actually out. I got an advanced copy, but it will be out very soon if it is not already out.
Title again?
The title is Widow's Wreath by Cynthia Riggs.
Right, so there's wreaths. She always has some kind of flower or plant in her titles. Did you ever notice that?
That's true now that you mention it.
Mary Fran?
I'm going to do what might seem like an unusual summer read. It's Eric Larson's In the Garden of Beasts. His other books, Dead Wake and Devil in the White City, read like fiction. And so that's an easy read, but really interesting. In the Garden of Beasts was the one I liked the best of those three. It involves... it begins in 1933 in Berlin, and nobody in the United States wants to be the ambassador to Berlin. So this academic, William Dodd, agrees to do this, and he becomes the first ambassador to actually go to Hitler's Germany. He brings his family. It's at a time, it's not the State Department of today. The families are expected to pay their own way. They have to pay for their functions. And it's very hard for somebody who isn't wealthy to hang on to this position. But what William Dodd starts seeing is the rise of Hitler. And nobody will believe him in Washington. You know, he keeps trying to get the message across, but it doesn't come out. So, yes, it's a more serious book, but it's a good read. And very... not throwing facts at you, but you absorb them as you read it.
I love nonfiction that reads like fiction. Mm. That's a really tough thing to
do. Yes,
But it's so enjoyable. Yeah, as you're saying, you're not having to process a lot of dry material. Yeah, although I'm mostly nonfiction.
Narrative nonfiction is a growing category.
Yeah.
In fact, we have a book club now at the library. That's what they do. Once a month, they read narrative nonfiction. And it's amazing the topics they've covered as they've gone through all of these various things. And I'm sure Eric Larson has been on their list.
I would think he would be. Yes.
Yeah, I would hope so. All right. We are talking about books for your summer reading list. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are offering suggestions for your summer reading list with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Mary Fran Buckley from Eight Cousins Bookstore. Jill, what have you got next?
I have to mention a little experiment we're doing at the library this year. We got a book, and this doesn't often happen. Usually we read reviews, we get the book. It looks like the book we thought we had ordered. Only in this case, when this book arrived, it did not look like the book we thought we had ordered. The book is called An Alternative Guidebook to the Beaches of Cape Cod, Cape Cod Notebook. Now, anyone that listens to CAI regularly, you say Cape Cod Notebook and you think of Robert Finch, who does have two beautiful little books called A Cape Cod Notebook. So we get this and we open this book up and discover that what it is essentially is a journal. It's a beach journal for you to fill out as you go to each beach on Cape Cod. So thinking, you know, how do we take this lemon, make lemonade? I get the idea that maybe what would be really fun is to let the book go out and let people fill it out. So we have, in fact, taken our copy of the book And there were lots of holds on this, so we couldn't, like, not circulate it. So this is what we've written. And yes, you heard that right. The librarians have written
in a book
of the book. And what it says is, this book is unique. Why? Because we are inviting you to help write in it. Please share your beach day with everyone. Tell us about the view, the sand, the waves. Was the bird watching good? How about sharks, boats, surfers, crowds? Thank you for your thoughtful comments. They just might inspire someone to discover a new favorite Cape Cod beach. And so a couple of our staff members have also already written in the book. And for example, our director wrote, she particularly loves Washburn Island. So she wrote, Washburn Island is owned by the state, accessible only by boat. It has many stretches of sandy beach. On a sunny day, arrive early to claim your spot. It is an easy kayak from White's Landing. These are my favorite Falmouth beaches. But again, this is the whole Cape. So because of the way our network works and how this book could end up anywhere, it could end up in Provincetown, it could end up on the Vineyard. So we're hoping everybody that gets the book adds their favorite beach. I put in my favorite beach, which is Woodneck Beach, which is one of the reasons it's my favorite, is because it's the first beach. I used to live very close to it, so I could walk to it. So we're going to see how this experiment works, and I will report back when we see the book again, because I don't know, once it goes out and leaves our building, we don't know when it will come back, but I do have a hold on it, so I'm hoping after a few people write in it, it's going to be a great experiment. And it is called the Cape Cod Notebook, an alternative guidebook to the beaches of Cape Cod. And I regret to say I don't actually have the author's name on it, but I promise you that I will put that when we post the list, we will put up her name, because I unfortunately didn't bring that with me.
The update on this.
I couldn't bring the actual book because it's already circulating.
So how many copies did you get?
We only have one.
You have one.
We have one.
But you had like 12 holds on it or something like that?
Wow. And there's another copy that some other library also got. Uh-huh. I don't think they're probably doing what we're doing. But
well, they might now that they've heard this.
They
right?
might.
All right, Mary Friend, what have you got?
I'm continuing with nonfiction, which is not my normal genre, but I have been reading a lot more lately. And this one is totally unusual for me, but I was absolutely captivated by it. It's called The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. It's for anybody who has had a moving company, has moved, or has shaken their fist at a truck while they drive on the highway. You'll change your mind after reading this book. So the author, Finn Murphy, is not what you would think of as a usual trucker. He's very well educated, 3 years at Colby College. But after 3 years, he decided, I'm wasting my time here. I want to go, and I'm going to be a trucker. He had worked at a gas station at 15, and he'd worked his way up to a local trucking company. His parents are not at all pleased. In fact, his father, when he does decide to do this, presents him with a bill for 3 years of tuition at Colby. They don't. Finn doesn't answer if he had to pay back, because he's just totally outraged by his father. But in the introduction, here is what he says. You are about to go out on the road with me, a long-haul mover. It's a road uncongested by myth. You'll see the work, meet the families I move, and visit for a while with some of the people who populate this subculture. You'll smell the sweat, drink in the crummy bars, eat the disgusting food, manage an unruly labor pool, and meet some strange people. But I hope you'll also experience the exhilaration and the attraction of the life out there. You'll also see what really happens behind the scenes when a family calls in the van line to pursue that all-powerful American imperative, the next big thing. More than 40 million Americans move every year. Careful people who lock their doors, carry umbrellas, and install alarm systems, casually and routinely consign everything they own over to the movers without a second thought. I find that a bit odd, don't you? And later on, he notes that we know more about you in 30 minutes than your friends have known about you all your life.
Oh, interesting, huh?
And he does, but he has very interesting observations throughout. And he has wonderful references to books. Talking about one of the mover vans, he compared it. We checked out the trailer first. It was a mover Sistine Chapel. And he's very proud of his work. He's The blue-collar truckers can't understand him. He speaks so well. And the white-collar customers can't figure out what he's doing driving a truck. And he does take a break. He finds it gets a bit, not boring, but hard. And he comes back. He continues doing it. And who knew? There's a whole hierarchy of truckers. And the people who do the moving are at the bottom of the hierarchy. Hmm. But he has other interesting observations, once again, about knowing the customers so well. And it has a lot to do with our stuff, the things we keep. Movers are there at the beginning point of accumulation and all the points to the bitter end. So we tend to develop a Buddhist view of attachment. We do not covet your stuff. It's freight. We'll take the best care we can because you're paying for that and we're responsible for the damage claim. But we don't care any other so-called higher level because no higher level actually exists. Sentimental value of stuff is a graven image and a mug's game. The only beneficiary is the self-storage guy. What my customers need to know is that it's not the stuff, but the connection with people and family and friends that matters. Practically everyone I move gets this wrong. Mm. So it's a really interesting read, yeah. and one that I wouldn't normally pick up. Recommended by our Norton rep.
And what's the title of that?
I'm sorry. It's The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road by Finn Murphy.
Oh, wow. Right. Sounds fascinating.
And he started in Connecticut, so he's got this little New England bias as well.
All right, Jill?
Well, I have a book that's on my summer reading list, and it got there because a good friend of mine discovered this book. This came out some years ago and was just raving about it. And she's telling me this is the best book she has ever read. And she's a big reader. So I'm like, gee, I'm going to have to look into that. And it is called The Blazing World by Siri Hustvedt. And it is about a woman artist of a certain age and how she is struggling to be recognized in an art world in New York City that really only recognizes men. And so in this Me Too movement, this actually is a very interesting read, I think. And the New York Times reviewed it back in 2014. And it starts saying in the 1980s, a series of posters began appearing on the streets of New York. The most arresting one, a yellow and crimson image of Ingres Odalesque wearing a gorilla mask that demanded, "Do women have to be naked to get into the Met Museum?" informed the viewer that less than 5% of the artists in the modern art sections are women, but 85% of the nudes are female. The Blazing World, Siri Hustvedt's sixth novel, plays on the same art world gender bias as the protest campaign by a group called the Guerrilla Girls. Harriet Burden, Hustvedt's pugnacious heroine, is an artist whose phantasmagoric multimedia installations created from the 1970s to her death in 2004 have never received the acclaim they deserve. The Blazing World, presented as a posthumous sampler of Burden's diaries, critics' discussions of her work, and interviews with her family, friends, and collaborators, is a portrait of a creative titan whose career and reputation have seemingly been blighted by the art establishment's ingrained sexism. Mm. So I think it's going to be, and it's also, as far as I can tell from the little bit I've read so far, is also funny. And she starts in, and they, as it said in the review, it's basically her journals and letters that they're reprinting. And it starts in one of her notebooks. "I started making them about a year after Felix died. Totems, fetishes, signs, creatures like him and not so like him. Odd bodies of all kinds that frightened the children, even though they were grown up and didn't live with me anymore. They suspected a version of grief gone off the rails, especially after I decided that some of my carcasses had to be warm so that when you put your arms around them, you could feel the heat. Maisie told me to take it easy. Mom, it's too much. You have to stop, Mom. You're not young, you know." And Ethan, true to his Ethan self, expressed his disapproval by naming them the maternal monsters, the dad things, and pater horribilian. Only Avon, wondrous grand babe, approved of my beloved beasties. She was not yet two at the time, and approached them soberly and with great delicacy. She loved to lay her cheek against a radiant belly and coo. So I think this, I'm in for a real treat. I hope some of you will also pick it up. It's called The Blazing World by Siri Hustvedt.
Yeah, I always love that when somebody you know who's an avid reader says, this is the best book, when you go, I have to read that if they say it's the best book they've ever read. Yeah.
So along the same lines of the Me Too movement is Young Jane Young by Gabriel Zevin. And it's finally in paperback, which I'm pleased. So it'll be a great one to bring to the beach. And the interesting thing about it is it had to have been written before the explosion of hashtag Me Too. It's about Jane Young, a young woman who works for a congressman, has an affair with him, gets pregnant, and of course, she leaves town and starts a new life, and he continues in his role. The story is told through the voices of her mother, and now I'm not remembering some of the other people, and also her daughter, and then finally with Jane Young. And it's just a great read. The dialogue is just terrific. It would make a wonderful movie just with the dialogue alone. And Gabriel Zevin is beloved by booksellers because of A.J. Fickrey. And that's another book about a bookstore. And it's sort of like Martha's Vineyard. It's a bookstore on an island. She also writes for young adult. We have a number of her books in young adult. And this book is a wonderful one for teenage girls to read, I think. It has a terrific ending. I won't give it away. Mm. But she's just got a wonderful voice, the character does, as does the author. So that's Young Jane Young by Gabriel Zevin.
Just a couple minutes left. Jill?
I just want to say that one of the things that I am looking forward to, this is actually coming out in August, is Susanna Kearsley has a new book coming out called Bellwether. If you have never read Susanna Kearsley, pick up any of them, really. As she says, there's a bit of everything in her novels. There's mystery, but it's not a body in the library sort of mystery. There's romance, but it's not always front and center. There's often something paranormal going on, but it's not too strange or creepy. And I think there's a certain old style suspense to the story. She writes beautifully. This one happens to be set on the 1750s on Long Island. But then, of course, as with most of her novels, you come into the present. So you're dealing, the past and the present are always sort of mixing together. It's a work of historical fiction inspired by her family history, takes the readers back to colonial Long Island and the French and Indian War. I think it's going to be a great read. And if you haven't already read other things by her, take a look for Susanna Kearsley. Diana Gabaldon, who a lot of you know from Outlander, writes on the cover Spellbinding. I've loved every one of Susanna's books. And they're good summer reads because they're interesting. There's some romance. There's some history. But they're not overly taxing. So the perfect books for summer reading, anything by Susanna Kearsley, I think would be well read.
All right. We have about a minute or so for the last book.
I'll do a quick one, even though I have a few more here. And this is We Were Liars by E. Lockhart. It is going to be
coming. I get the shivers just thinking about it. I haven't read that.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
Don't say too much.
I won't. In fact, in the flyleaf, it says, We Were Liars is a modern, sophisticated suspense novel from National Book Award finalist and Prince Award honoree E. Lockhart. Read it. And if anyone asks you how it ends, lie. So it is an island off of Cape Cod that a very wealthy family owns. And I tell you, the twist in the plot just really, it's amazing.
Right.
It's great.
And we will have a link to all of the books we talked about this morning a little bit later up on our website, capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Mary Fran Buckley from Eight Cousins Bookstore. Thank you both for your suggestions.
Thank you, Mindy.
Got a busy summer of reading here. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.